So, the work I'm going to talk about today is done by this gentleman right here, Kurt Nittmeyer, a graduate student working in my group. So we're going to talk about jamming and business extensions. So this is sort of, in some sense, a sort of a rheological study, but it's different from most in that when you look at rheology, usually you want to know how things flow. And that's part of the interest here, but there's also a lot of interest in how things stop flowing and figure how they jam up. So it perhaps distinguishes it from other research that's been done in this area. But just by way of introduction, if you look at the viscosity of a suspension of, say, spheres in a liquid, and you measure its viscosity, what you find is that if you don't have very many spheres in the suspension, you get just the underlying viscosity of the liquid. But then as you increase the concentration of spheres, say, measure their concentration from the volume fraction, you quite generally, for virtually any kind of system you imagine, get a curve that looks something like this. It is viscosity increases monotonically as a function of volume fraction, and at some point it diverges. Where it diverges depends upon the details of the interactions between the particles. So in this case, what we're interested in some sense, the simplest system that one could possibly imagine. That is, we're interested in spheres that interact with each other essentially only by means of a hard sphere repulsive potential, although you'll see it's not quite so hard in the end, and we'll want to think a little bit about the compressibility of these spheres. But basically, there's no long-range interaction between them. And in that case, at low volume fractions, you have this famous Einstein expression for how the viscosity goes. But at higher volume fractions, there's a little bit more debate about exactly how the divergence, how the viscosity diverges. And a number of people have studied that issue both experimentally and theoretically. However, our focus isn't in some sense so much on how this diverges. It is, it's not so much on the physics that occurs as you come at this curve from this end. We're more interested in some sense at what happens, what the behavior is as you come at this divergence from this end. All right. So we'll show you some experiments along that line. So the viscosity diverges at high volume fractions. Here's just some issues that some people have looked at. One thing at very high volume fractions that you probably ought to be, you ought to think about is that the system's extremely sensitive to the short range interactions. I mean, that's not true at the lower volume fractions. But you might imagine that the flow behavior of such suspensions is highly affected by particles that come very near to contacting each other, and in some cases, perhaps even contacting each other. If they do come into contact, obviously that's going to change things quite a bit. One thing, for example, that people who work in ceramics do is they purposely charge their spheres. And what they find is that by charging them, they actually make the system less viscous in the vicinity of this divergence because they keep them from coming into very close contact. And that's important, say, for processing a ceramic before it's dried and fired. But it is important to understand that these kinds of suspensions are very sensitive to short-range interactions. An important parameter here is the Peckley number. The Peckley number just tries to compare, essentially, you can think of it in a number of ways, the time scale for motion due to an imposed flow versus the time scale for motion because of diffusion. All right, so it's usually written something like this. a shear rate, so that's the inverse time for flow, and B over A squared might be a characteristic time for diffusion, all right? And so we're going to be working in the limit that this number is very, very large. For our experiments, it's on the order of 10 to the 8. Depends a little bit about how you define it. But I think if you define it in the most reasonable way, you get a number on the order of 10 to the 8. So what that says is that for our experiments, Brownian motion should not be very important. A question here, obviously, I think it's obvious, that if you increase volume fraction, at some point, the system no longer flows and is jammed. One of the questions that we're interested in is, where does this occur? And as those of you who were here yesterday might remember, I like to think about this in a particular way. Namely, you know that at 63% for spheres, at random flow is happening, that the system's going to jam, and jam in a very profound sense, in the sense that if you try and apply a stress to the system, it simply will not flow. The only way you'll get any deformation at all in that case is if the particles themselves are elastic and they are deformed. All right, but you can ask the question, what happens is you lower the volume fraction from that random flows packed limit. I think what you expect to happen is that the system properly prepared, say prepared in as loose a state as you could manage, might flow a little bit. That is, you might be able to apply a strain and have the system, or a stress and have the system go through some finite strain without deforming the particles. But at some point, you might expect that the particles would come into contact and would be unable to move past each other. And so in that case, the system would be jammed, but only jammed for finite strains. And so one central question that we're interested in is there a volume fraction below which the system always flows, no matter how big the strain is, and above which the system doesn't flow for some finite amount of strain?
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Actually, I hope that you'll just interrupt me all the way throughout this. This is a talk designed for interruptions.
If you've got a reasonably large system, if you just back off a fraction from RCP, then you could get the formation of a shear band.
Right.
And so it's inhomogeneous, but then you have infinite shear at any arbitrary point close to...
Right. Actually, that's something that we'll try and examine with our experiments. And I think what we'll see, and what you might expect just intuitively, is that it depends critically on how you prepare the system, of course. And of course, one thing that complicates complicates experiments even more so, is that since there's essentially no thermal energy in this problem, there's no well-defined, obvious starting state. You have to make it up. I mean, one nice thing about thermodynamic systems is all you have to do is wait, and nature defines for you a well-characterized starting state. Here we don't have that, and so that's going to be really important for us to define that very carefully in order to get experiments that are reproducible and ones that have some hope of being understood theoretically. Yeah?
How about thermodynamic interactions?
Okay, so we'll talk a little bit about the hydrodynamic interactions in the course of this. The hydrodynamic interactions are important, of course, particularly at these high densities. You imagine that when you have two particles come together, you basically have these lubrication forces that tend to keep particles apart. That is, when you push two particles together, you have to squeeze the liquid out, all right? as the space between the two spheres gets smaller and smaller, that driving force becomes smaller and smaller. It's harder and harder to push them to push that fluid out. And so that, and then if you just imagine shearing that, also you get quite a bit of viscous resistance, viscous dissipation.
Hard to pull them apart as well.
It's hard to pull them apart as well. All right. So the dynamics get slowed down a great deal by all of this. And I'll say some specific things about it. You'll see that at least in a few ways it comes into the experiment. Then there's an interesting question then as to, and people may have different opinions, insights into the question of how much an experiment of this kind has to do, say, with dry granular materials. And I think that's an interesting question.
It was very interesting. I mean, another question is actually in the Davout regime, whether there are effective long-range interactions in particles.
There are hydrodynamic interactions. There certainly are long-range hydrodynamic interactions. So this actually, Einstein's formula here doesn't take those into account, but then there's a phi squared term that comes after this phi term that then involves interactions. Hydrodynamic interaction between particles. Obviously, you have other. Were you going to say something, Robin?
No, I wouldn't say it's quite correct. Of course, the phi squared term famously depends upon more than just the volume fraction.
Oh, and what sense do you mean?
Well, it depends upon the Pecklet number. And
oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely, sure. Okay. I mean, that's just a way of saying, I guess another way of saying that is that in that case, and there are terms that contribute to the stress that involve Brownian motion and terms that involve pure hydrodynamics. So the phi squared term becomes a little bit significantly more complicated.
Well, the stress depends on the presence or absence of Brownian motion.
Right. Okay, so. I want to tell you about a couple of experiments, and in particular this one that was the reference for it is down here in Physical Review Letters in 1990, published by these two guys who I've never met. They were at IBM at the time when they performed these experiments, and they were trying to ask what seems to me to be an interesting question, and people have seemed to have had various opinions about this idea that they had. They were interested in something called random loops, or that they call random loops packing, which they defined as the loosest packing that can support an external load. And they did a couple different experiments. Their system consisted of a roughly 200 micron silica spheres, all right, and they put it in a solvent that was a mixture of two organic solvents, toluene and some chlorinated solvent, as I recall, which allowed them to density match or nearly density match the silica spheres. All right, and they, the first experiment, they did both experiments, I think, in a Couette cell. So this is just two concentric cylinders, one that fits inside the other with a gap between the two. And then one thing they did is they just took particles and dropped them in, all right, and essentially filled up the container and then asked what the volume fraction was as a function of the gravitational force. And they varied the gravitational force just by varying the buoyancy. So they did this from...
Were they shearing this one?
They weren't shearing. They just did that. Then, in a second experiment, they sheared the solution, the suspension, and measured the same thing. Here, they sheared it until they got some sort of equilibrium height here for the suspension, and then again measured that as a function of the buoyancy of these particles, so that they could take the buoyancy to zero. And the results are plotted here. And this is their attempt to find this random loose packing limit. And so the result of these two experiments, A is the experiment on the left, and B is the experiment on the right, and they more or less track each other with a little bit of a difference. And as you extrapolate towards delta G equals zero, okay, so that towards perfect buoyancy, which they obviously don't want to achieve if they're going to have well-defined experiments here, they tend towards a number of about, you know, on the order of 55%, all right? So they said, all right, they said there is such a thing as random loose packing, and then somewhere in the neighborhood of 55%, which of course is well below random close packing, which is closer to 60%.
What is the thing on the vertical axis?
That's the packing factor.
What was the criteria by which they stopped the experiment and declared it?
Well, in the first one, it was filling up the container. All right, it was just basically filling up the container. In the second one, they sheared it, all right? And as a function of shear rate, they looked at the height of the particles and they waited for it to come to some asymptote. And so they said this was sort of the limit. They defined this as sort of the limit of dilatancy and said, okay, it looks like both of these things give an answer that's roughly the same. There is some systematic difference, but that was the result of their measurements.
And the load that's being supported here is just the weight of the particles?
It's just the weight of the particles, all right, and they can vary that by varying the buoyancy.
And this would be independent of the height of the container, for example?
Well, in the limit, this part would be dependent upon the height of the container, but in the limit that delta G goes to zero, you would suspect not.
It would be, so did they test that?
They did do a few different heights. I don't, to tell you the truth, I don't remember off the top of my head exactly what they did there. But you would expect just to get different curves for different heights, and you would hope that they all extrapolate to the
same
height.
The size of the spheres were what?
Around 200 nanometers, 200 microns, sorry.
200 microns,
okay. And 250, the gap. And the gap was about 2 millimeters, as I recall. It wasn't that big of a gap. Maybe 2.5 millimeters, something on that order. So it was on the order of 10 or so particles across, so you might. There might be a little bit of a finite size effect there. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting experiment. Another interesting experiment, actually, I wanted to find a different experiment, but I didn't have time. But this illustrates well enough just what I wanted to point out. Actually, the experiment by Onoda and Lindinger, however you say his name, is a very unique experiment. I don't know too many experiments quite like this. This experiment over here that was published a couple years ago by a French group, a group from Paris, there is a very interesting experiment in and of itself, but there have been other experiments that see similar sorts of things. The idea here was that they looked at a suspension. They were looking at smaller particles. People have done this with, so they were looking at particles along the order of a micron in size where grounding motion might be important. And what they did, basically, was a measurement in a Couette device where they turned one of the cylinders at a constant shear rate and then measured the torque, essentially the stress on the other cylinder. And what they saw was at high concentrations, they saw fluctuations, large spiky fluctuations in the stress, all right, which they attributed to particles coming in contact with each other. This kind of experiment sort of begins to get at some of the same questions we're interested in, but not quite. That is, when you imagine a system jams, you imagine that particles come into contact, but this type of experiment doesn't allow jamming. I mean, it's defined in such a way that jamming can't occur, because what you do is here you impose a constant shear rate by just turning this at a fixed speed, and then the motor connected to that is so strong that the stress simply adjusts to make it go at that speed,
so
no matter
say
what.
Shear rate, you mean angular?
The angular velocity is just fixed there, and so
shear rate might be different in the gap, depending on.
Well, the average shear rate across the gap is fixed. There may be spatial fluctuations in the shear rate, and most certainly are. But in that case, then you often see these fairly large stress spikes, all right? But you're not going to see jamming. You'll see something that it may want to jam, but the system will automatically apply sufficient stress to break up any jam that occurs. And so we wanted to do an experiment that really was in another limit.
I'm sorry, but one of those experiments with settling, why is there no jamming there?
I didn't say there was no. Here, over here, these experiments were done the same way. They were.
Well, I'm sorry, the left one there.
Over here, there was no shear applied. All right, this is just dropping particles and looking at how they pack and what the volume fraction is. And they had this device for turning the strength of gravity by just using the buoyancy.
But I would thought that the reason they support load there is precisely because they're jammed in but they're not jammed?
No, I assume they are jammed. I assume they are jammed there. But I assume that in some sense they are jammed. So I agree with that. But then there's no essentially mechanical probing of this jam state in those experiments, and so we want to mechanically probe these states. This is just to say this is the sort of thing that you might imagine occurs when jamming happens. You imagine that there's some kind of force chain that goes across the system, and that. That supports the stress. One thing that's interesting is you might ask what happens if you reverse the stress and you would expect that the system would probably flow initially, but that some sort of jamming would form in the opposite direction after some finite strain. So this just summarized some of the things I said in the previous view graph about doing experiments at constant shear rate, which prohibits you from looking at jamming. So if jamming is what you want to look at, then I would claim that the sort of mechanical measurement you want to do in this context involves a similar experiment, but one where you impose a fixed stress and then let the system respond as it will. So it may move or it may jam, all right? But the idea is really to apply constant stress. So that's what we want. That's what we want to do. That was our approach here. Let's see. So another question is why to study jamming in non-colloidal suspensions. By non-colloidal, I mean no Brownian motion. It's a term that sometimes used to designate that. One is basically to eliminate the effect of diffusion. We're not so much interested in here. Diffusion, to my way of thinking, is always a way of undoing jamming. That is, if you go slowly enough and you allow the system to diffuse, it can always find a way to escape the jam state. So since it's jamming we want to study, we want to stay away from systems where Brownian motion is important. One thing that's nice about using suspensions as opposed to using normal granular materials is that it offers the possibility of doing two things that are potentially nice. One is getting rid of gravity. all right, so that you can study jamming in the absence of gravity and in the presence of some imposed stress or force. And then the other thing that's nice about it is it offers up also the possibility of index matching your particles to the liquid so that you can see inside, which is difficult to do in granular materials that are dry. All right, so it's those two things, the matching of the density and the matching of the refractive index, that also led us to look at these kinds of systems. So the particular system we use is a suspension of polymethyl methacrylate spheres. We use ones with a diameter in between about 210 and 250 microns. So there's essentially no grounding motion. They're too big. As I said, the Pecklin numbers on the order of 10 to the 8. We've deliberately made them polydisperse. That is, we didn't really want to understand. We really didn't want to study. We want to understand everything. But we really didn't want to study shear-induced crystallization. All right, that's another issue. And so we made them deliberately polydisperse in the hopes of avoiding shear-induced crystallization. The liquid in which they're suspended is one that is a formulation by Leighton at Notre Dame. And the liquid is a mixture of three different components that are designed to allow you to match the refractive index and density of PMMA. The important thing to know about the liquid is that the liquid itself is completely Newtonian over all the shear rates assessed in this experiment, and it has a viscosity of, if I recall correctly, 3 pascal seconds, which is 300 centipoints. All right, yeah, 3,000 times that of water. Okay, so here's our system, and here's our experiment. So the experiment is done in the cuvette cell, and there are a number of things that are done to try and make sure that we get believable results. The bottom of the cell is filled with mercury. That way we have a uniform shear volume, that is, you don't need down here, if this were not full, you would have two problems. You could have a shear rate that was a function of where you were in the gap, and also the number of particles that span the gap would be varying, and neither of those things are good. So here this allows us to have a constant gap. The ratio of the cell gap to particle diameter goes from about 10 to 100. That is, we use gaps of 2 millimeters, 4 millimeters, and 10 millimeters to see how that affects our results. The walls are roughened. What we actually do with the walls is we glue particles of the same, we glue the same particles that we use in suspension to both of these walls. All right, and so that gives us a wall that is rough on the same length scale as the particles in order to avoid slippage at the edges. And then, of course, we apply a constant torque to this. This is connected up to a commercial rheometer, and it's very sensitive. You can go down to very low torques and measure very low stress with this.
What's the gap width of the cylinder?
Let's see. So the gap is 2, 4, 10. This distance is on the order of 2.5 centimeters, something like that. Okay. Any other questions about this? All right. So, like I said at the beginning, having a well-defined initial state is important in order to get reproducible results. In this case, nature doesn't hand it to you, so you have to come up with something that you think is a good place to start. So this is the procedure we came up with. We call it degaussing, which those of you who worked with old-fashioned oscilloscopes that had CRT tubes will understand the term. Others of you need not worry about it. But what we do is we take the system, load it into the sample. Actually, we actually shear it for a day or so to get all the air bubbles out. But then to prepare, we undergo oscillatory shear flow by initially applying a stress that's fairly large, large enough to have a strain that's on the order of 3. And then over the period of about an hour, we reduce the size of the stress and hence the size of the strain excursions until eventually we hit essentially zero. And at the end, this is being oscillated very rapidly. I think in the beginning it's maybe the frequencies on the order of a second, is it, occur?
It's about 10 seconds.
10 seconds to begin with, and at the end it's how fast?
I think it goes over about 4 decades.
So it's rather fast at the end. But at any rate, the idea is it's some kind of shaking, which we hope will leave the system in a well-defined, more or less loosely packed state, or as loosely packed as you can get for whatever volume fraction you're at. And it seems to work quite well. That is, we get very reproducible results this way. We rather like this way of preparing it, but it's obviously not the only way you could imagine doing it. A typical experiment might look like this. After you prepare it in this state, then what you do is you pick a stress and you apply it, starting at time t equals 0, and then you monitor how far and at what rate the inner cylinder moves. All right, so you just look at that motion as a function of time. Now, there's lots of ways of characterizing the data, and different people like different ways of doing it. The way we've chosen to do it, and you just have to get used to it if you don't like it, is in terms of a reduced viscosity. So what we do is the viscosity, we say, is simply the applied stress over the instantaneous shear rate that we measure. And that's the instantaneous viscosity. So it's a function of time because the configuration of the particles is changing as a function of time. So, and then we divide that by the viscosity of the solvent. So it starts out with a relatively low viscosity, and as you start to strain it, so we just plot this as, rather than time, we plot a dimensionless time, if you will. We plot it in terms of strain. And what you see in this case is you see that the viscosity rises fairly rapidly, goes through a peak, and then decreases and reaches some sort of steady state. The peak generally occurs at a strain on the order of 1 or a little less than 1. And that depends, of course, a little bit on volume fraction. But this is a fairly typical type of curve, yeah.
I mean, is it too ambitious to imagine instrumenting this in such a way that you could detect the normal forces?
We do some normal force experiments, but not in, and I'll talk about those, but not in the Couette geometry. That doing it in the Couette geometry is indeed an ambitious set of experiments. But the normal forces are important, and we do measure those in another set of experiments. And here they are. I forgot that they're after the next. They're perhaps not the best normal forces, normal force measurements in the world due to various limitations. But here's the thing to understand. Obviously, if you take a suspension like this and shear, and the particles start running into each other, you might expect that there would be a force on the plates pushing them apart. All right, so that's referred to as the normal force. And usually it's measured, it's characterized in terms of the normal force difference. If you want to define it carefully, you have a normal stress tensor. You have a stress tensor, all right, use the various components of the stress tensor that you normally think you have in a homogeneously sheared liquid. You have the diagonal elements, and the average of the diagonal elements is minus the pressure. The off-diagonal elements here are what you associate normally with the shear stresses. In unshared liquid, these three are going to be the same. The diagonal elements are just all going to be by the pressure. But when you shear it, these three elements don't have to be the same. They can be different from each other. And the way that you usually characterize and parameterize is you specify the pressure, which is essentially one-third the trace of the stress tensor. And then you define two differences. The difference between these two elements is the first normal stress, and then the second normal stress, which some people define as the difference between these two, and others the difference between these two. But we're going to talk about the first normal stress difference. And what we see interesting.
You're also going to tell us what are the x and y directions.
X is the flow direction. Y is the velocity gradient direction. Thank you. Standard thing. So here is a plot of one experiment where we have the viscosity as a function of time, the reduced viscosity, and the normal stress difference as a function of time for a system that flows. All right, this isn't for a jammed system. This is for a system that flows. And one thing that's interesting about a system that flows is that the first normal stress difference in its concentrated suspension is negative. All right, that should strike you as odd. All right, that at least is counterintuitive, I think. So what happens is it says that when you shear like this in a dense suspension, one that's not jammed, the two plates are actually drawn together. All right, and this seems this is a result that a number of people have observed experimentally. It's fairly well established, and has also is actually understood from a theoretical point of view, mainly through the numerical work of John Brady down at Caltech. And he sees these negative first normal stress differences. Also, a student of his working independently after he finished, Jeff Morris, who's at CCNY, has also studied these kinds of things in the same context. Yeah.
Are those normalized?
No, those aren't normalized.
I mean, if you normalize, what's the percentage?
What's interesting, this is a correct statement. The best of measurements, and both experimentally, and our measurements, I wouldn't say are the best measurements, but they're okay measurements. The best ones are probably by a guy named Laun in Germany, and a paper published on the order of 10 years ago. But both his experiments, and it's consistent with our experiments, and Brady and Morris's independent simulations, get something quite interesting. The first normal stress difference is essentially equal to the shear stress.
So this is saying the principal axes are 45 degrees?
Near 45 degrees. Near 45 degrees. They're not exactly at 45 degrees. This turns out, trying to understand this intuitively is, I find, a little bit difficult. But I'll offer you what I understand, both just thinking about it on my own and talking with John and Jeff. John makes the statement, actually, I don't think I put this up here, I should check. Well, maybe I did. There's all that stuff. I sort of did. I forgot what I had here. So this is just saying what I just said about the normal stresses. When things jam, you'd expect to have a positive normal stress. But when they're flowing, you can get two different contributions. If you're shearing like this, all right, and you imagine two particles that are oriented at 45 degrees with respect to the flow, as I've shown here, then the imposed shear flow would tend to try and pull these particles apart. In order to pull them apart, you have strong lubrication forces that would suck particle into the gap in between the fluid. And what John Brady says is, of course, that kind of sucking in will give rise to a negative normal stress. Yes.
I mean, if I
if I understand properly, the naive expectation would be that they would be at 45 degrees, that the principal axes would be at 45
right,
degrees
in
neither case, neither the dry or the wet case. So there are two parts of this that are interesting. The first is that the stress difference is negative in the lubricated case, and there's a candidate explanation
right.
for that rating. The second is that it's not, in fact, exactly 45 degrees.
I don't know. I don't quite know what to say about the 45 degrees in some sense.
The range of strain tensor still has its own pitch axis at 45 degrees. It's just you're asking about the stress tensor.
I'm asking about the stress tensor.
Right.
If N1 is of order sigma xy, then principal axes and the stress tensor are far from 45.
Yeah, they get tilted a bit. They get tilted off of 45 degrees. That is, if you look at various simulations, they're not precisely at 45 degrees.
I mean, they're not a little bit off. If really you're saying that N1 is more than sigma x1, which I agree is where everybody sees, that says you're more than a bit off 45.
Perhaps so. I mean, the thing that seemed bizarre to me about this explanation and made me realize that it's a little bit subtle. Is this, while this argument would give rise to a negative normal stress, and I think that makes sense, particles oriented like this, which are getting pushed together, the same lubrication force would give rise to a positive normal stress. And so, in fact, the one that wins has to depend fairly sensitively on what the distribution of particles, the angular distribution of particles is. That is, if you looked at something like the pair distribution function, g of r, but in particular looked at g of r as a function of theta, it would be important to understand that in some detail. Now, without making a whole lecture of it, I think when you look at Brady's work and when you look at Jeff Morris's work, which has probably done the best work in trying to understand this, it's fair to say that it's complicated and it's subtle, all right? Because you do get both contributions, and which one wins is, at least in talking to these guys and thinking about it myself, I'd be damned if I could guess which one would win. But
it depends on what the orientation distribution is.
It depends on what the orientation, but to give you a feeling for how subtle it is in John's first paper that he published on this, later on in a different context, he published what G of R was for particles in contact, and he defined contact as being like something like within 1% of the inner particle diameter, or something like that. And when he did that, he found that there was a peak in the paracorrelation function, not for our particles oriented like this, but for particles oriented like that. And so then when I talk further with John and with Jeff Morris, they tell me, well, a simple argument like that doesn't work, it turns out. You have to consider particles that are further out. There's some...
Dynamics, presumably, that's important.
What?
Dynamics, presumably, important.
I'm sorry.
Dynamics, presumably, is important.
Yes, the dynamics, presumably,
they
are
important.
They
can come together and move apart asymmetrically.
Right. And so, if you see Jeff Morris sometime, you can have a nice long discussion. I talked to him about a half hour and I still didn't understand it in a way that I felt intuitively comfortable with. And I'm not sure he had an explanation. It was more or less, well, you got to do the calculation and this is what it gives.
Do these particles come into contact with one another?
All right. At this point, we've assumed not. All right. In the simulations...
No, I'm not asking...
Well, ours do. Ours will. And I will address that explicitly in probably the next or a view graph or two. But for this argument, There's no contact.
Well, there is, if you think about particles coming together and moving apart, mm-hmm. there's a lubrication dominated regime for which Brady's right. argument would be
right.
valid. And then there's a contact dominated.
Once they come into contact, Brady and Morris are completely out the window. They don't deal with contact.
These particles in their simulations are are numerically smooth.
Right.
And
I understand Brady's particles not coming to contact.
Oh no, actually that's not true. That's actually not true. Brady doesn't want his particles to come into contact, so he does a finesse, which is fine for what he's trying to look at. But there's this problem that Robin explored in some detail over the last 10 years about trying to do these numerical calculations, and you have to have extremely small, prohibitively small time steps to keep these particles from coming into contact. So what John did, for example, is he just said, okay, a certain number of them are going to come into contact. They do, they actually overlap, and then he pretends that they don't.
So he puts in effective roughness in some.
Oh no! What he does, he says that they're lubricated. He doesn't put in roughness. He just says he pretends that those are lubricated.
But what happens? What's got to happen is in any real experiment, any picture of smooth hard particles is going to break down. The particles are going to get close enough together
right.
that either microscopic roughness
yeah.
or all the delicate colloidal interactions that you designed into those particles to make them stably suspended in the first place
are going to keep
them
right.
Because these particles have to have non-trivial surfaces.
Right. By the way, the particles that we're working with, Kurt looked at them with a AFM and got a sort of RMS roughness of a couple nanometers, if I recall correctly.
What and how are they stabilized?
They're not. I mean, these are just PMMA. These are PMMA spheres you can hold in your hand and see.
This is a non-aqueous suspension.
It has a surfactant in it. Has water in it, and has some other chemical.
It is stabilized.
It is, in some sense, a little bit stabilized. These surfactants may have effects at small distance.
We would say they would.
Yeah, I guess they are stabilized in that sense, sure.
But these
materials
within it is liquid are all small molecules.
They're all small molecules. So it's what Triton X is a surfactant. It's not a very good
molecule. So you think the roughness scale is the
Triton,
key departure?
Yeah, it's probably the key departure. But the roughness isn't huge, 2 nanometers out of.
No, you were just trying to tell me.
That's what I think. Yes, you're absolutely correct. All right, so here, let's finally get through some data. Oh, do you want to ask a question?
No. Well, I guess I wanted to ask before, what's the time resolution here? You know, the noise that we see there is emergent noise, or is the actual stuff happening there?
The noise...
No, especially in the previous
slides,
right? So there was a lot of sort of high-frequency noise there.
The noise is probably due to here is due to the finite resolution of measuring the angular displacement of the inner cylinder. All right, at this point these things are going very slowly. All right, and so there's noise introduced, essentially just shot noise, due to the finite resolution of the angular displacement sensor.
Before you go, what are the colors?
Oh, this was the viscosity of the left-hand axis. The blue was the right-hand axis.
Which is the
normal force. That's the anomalous
normal stress.
It's the normal stress, and so the point that I wanted to make, main point I wanted to make here, is that it was negative when it flowed. All right. People have done more careful measurements than we're able to do. Get this relationship. We're in that ballpark, but I would say that. I also see there's probably some contact between particles here too.
Still trying to understand the time scale there. So these fastest wiggles are the measurement noise, but the slower wiggles are things happening.
The slower wiggles are real. All right. And my guess, this. All right. So to do this experiment, it's a bit we're not able to control the geometry and the experiment nearly as well. All right. Because to do the normal force measurement, we do it in what's called a parallel plate geometry. All right, and these two plates are rotating with respect to each other. There's all sorts of things wrong with this experiment from a quantitative point of view. Namely, the shear isn't constant. It varies as a function of radius. The shear at the center is zero. At the edge is maximum. All right, so it's not exposed to a constant shear rate, and therefore not constant shear stresses. In an ideal experiment where the entities here were very small, you do a cone and plate measurement where one of these would be shaped like a cone, and then you have a linearly varying gap which would give you a constant shear rate. And from those kinds of experiments, you can get quantitative information. Here, there's a problem since our particles are big and comparable to the size of the gap. You're going to get finite size effects if you try to do something like that. So here, the main point of doing this measurement was to see if we, like everybody else, in the flowing limit, actually got a negative normal stress. And the answer is yes. My guess, although we haven't explored it in any great detail, as to why you get this kind of wiggling, is it's at a fairly high volume fraction. This one, I think, was 54%. Is that?
I think it's 53.
53%, okay. My guess is that there may be some particles coming into contact here, particularly at the edge. So I wouldn't want to interpret this in any deep way. It was only to make the point that we do see these negative stress, normal stresses. Yes?
With respect to the dispute between myself and Robin that was going on, is that N1 or is that N1 over 2 that's about sigma x1?
That's N1. It's N1. Alright. Alright, so here's an interesting measurement. So here's a damming experiment performed at a fairly low stress. I'm not sure this one is actually, I think that's incorrect. I think this one was performed at a higher stress. I'm almost sure it was looking at the data. That's my mistake. But you get similar curves at the lower stress. What you see is that at 55% the system flows, at 56% it jams. All right. And although we've only gone out to a strain of 0.1 here, this experiment, if you continue going out with strain, this does flow. And so what you see is a fairly sharp transition. There is a volume fraction for our system below which a system always flows indefinitely, and above which it doesn't flow. Now, there's a weak gap dependence. It is, Kurt has done these experiments for gaps of 2 millimeters, 4 millimeters, and 10 millimeters, corresponding, the 2 millimeter one is about 8 or 9 particles across, all right, and then 100 particles across. And what we see is that as you go up in the gap, the volume fraction might go up by 1%. All right, yeah.
How long have you been able to stay in these jam states? Like, do you leave it there for
quite a long time. We don't see, this is just a question that Kurt was looking at a week ago. The question is, do you see creep? All right, and it seems we don't see any creep.
Okay, so it's just strictly jam.
There just seems to be jam. All right.
David, those strings there are actually surprisingly small to me.
Yeah.
About our simulations. That 55% sample, how far have you actually strained it?
Ten. I don't know, how far have you strained it, Kurt?
I can strain it over 10.
Yeah, long, long ways.
Yeah.
We're quite sure that this slopes. 10's got to be infinity. maybe.
So what happens at different stress?
What
happens at different stress?
Mostly, for the most part, it's stress independent. That is over the range of stresses that we can cover. Now,
but the highest stress.
The highest stress I think we get to in these experiments is 300 pascals. All right.
Do we see any creep?
And we don't see any creep. We do see, as I'll come back to, we do see there is elastic deformation of the particles. All right. There's clearly elastic deformation of the particles. Okay. And I'll come to that in a second. I guess in the 2 millimeter gap, there was, if you got the stress high enough, it jammed at 54%, except at very high stresses, it jammed at 54% up to 1 pascal, and above 1 pascal it flowed. But once he went up to 55%, it jammed at all the stresses up to 300 pascals. Yeah.
Would you expect as you increased polydispersity, this threshold to go down or up?
Ha! why ask me what I would expect? Would I expect it to go?
It's a trick question.
Would I expect it to go up or down? I guess I'll bite. You know, I don't mind being wrong in public.
This threshold is volume fraction.
So if you make it more polydispersed, I would predict it goes down. Okay. Did I get the right answer, Professor?
Well, I find that kind of surprising.
Yeah.
It's going to go up because of the maximum.
I meant you had a lower. That's exactly what I meant. That is, the idea is that the small particles, in some sense, don't matter.
Yeah.
Right. And so therefore, you have to go to a bigger volume fraction.
That's exactly what I meant to say.
I said it wrong, but that's the logic I would go through. Yeah. Is that the small particles don't matter once you get a lot of polydispersity.
Yeah. I mean that's the thing that bugged me, because
right.
0.55 for the uniform system, 0.55 seems a little low.
But look, the polydispersity here, I would claim is low. That is, these are what, 210 to 250 microns in diameter. The idea was we wanted to maintain a characteristic size of the particle. We didn't want a broad distribution. And I would be shocked, other than for things pertaining to shear induced ordering, if the polydispersity made any difference in terms of where it jammed. That I think I'd argue fairly, strongly.
Underline that last point, that key role of polydispersity is much more likely to be how it affects shear induced ordering.
Right. So this amount of polydispersity was chosen to hopefully frustrate shear induced ordering, but so as deliberately not to have a broad distribution of sizes, so that we could say the system is jamming at 55% for a particular size. That is where the volume fraction is characteristic of monodispersed spheres, other than the ordering question. All right, so that's my thinking on that.
Wait, could you remind us, so at any packing fraction, you always have this preparation procedure where you're in steady shear and then you do the degassing?
Yeah.
So even this phi equals 0.56, that you say that somehow it will jam, but you have the stress large enough so that you've started its life flowing. Right?
Yes, you can do that. Well, I'll come back to that, all right, because it's an interesting question, all right? So let's look at this jamming case in a little bit more detail, all right? And here's an interesting experiment, and there's one that goes along with it. This is a series of flow reversals. That is, we apply the stress and we let it jam. After it jams, we reverse the stress, same magnitude, and see what happens. If the stress is low, and this stress, I think, was 0.1 pascals, first it comes up here and it jams. All right. Then we reverse the stress. we pick up the data here, all right, here's the strain. We pick it up here, and we go back, or actually, I guess we pick it up here. Goes back, and it jams again, all right? Then we reverse it again, and it jams here. And then it jams here, 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 here. All right, this, to me, looks like a kind of work hardening, all right? That the system, it's when you go over here and jam in the other direction, it seems as though you don't quite completely undo the bridges that you built that caused the jamming here, all right? Which was a total surprise to me. I mean, actually, these experiments were totally Kurt's idea. I hadn't thought of doing them, and was totally taken back when we saw this kind of behavior, because I just naively expected that a flow reversal would undo the jam state in the other direction.
But this reversal is over a total strain of 2.5%.
Right.
So you're not changing the local environment of the particles.
Very much. Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, it's of the same order of the strain that originally jammed the system.
That would suggest that the behavior is incredibly sensitive to extreme, to, I would interpret, to very small changes in the starting structure, which makes you wonder about this degaussing. And
it absolutely does make you wonder a little bit about this degaussing. I wouldn't defend it in any strong way. The only thing I would say is that it does give reproducible results. I mean, the next experiment won't look precisely, it won't happen at precisely the same strains, all right? But it will give you the same work hardening behavior. Okay. Now, if you increase the stress, all right, so here's just a plot of, say, the maximum strain as a function of the reversal number, or run number. You can see it going back and forth and sort of coming to some limiting state. If you increase the strain, you can make it go the other direction. That is, what happens is it goes, you can see here, 1, 2, 3, 4. It gets wider and wider apart, all right? So this suggests to me that we're compressing the particles, all right? And as you'll see, we are indeed.
I don't understand why it gets wider here, but it got narrower.
Bigger stress.
Oh, you just
increase the stress. Done the same experiment, but at a larger stress. All right. So this goes back to your question about obviously you can break these things up. You can break them up. You break them up sort of by wiggling them, all right? But under a big enough stress.
The stress is constant during the motion?
The stress is constant in magnitude and only reverses in direction. So in this experiment, it was done at 0.1 pascals. Just we go 1 pascal.
Right? The stress and then wait till it stops.
Wait till it stops. And then reverse it and go back the other direction. All right? And so this one was done at 0.3 pascals. And so here it seems to go apart, and as far as long as we're willing to wait, it looks like it sort of comes to some limiting stress. I don't know. These experiments take a long time. So, if you go to higher stress, the system will simply break free, all right? So this is 1 pascal. And here, you just see things diverge and it eventually flows. So that presumably is what's happening during the degaussing process, all right? Until we get to very, very small things, all right? By the way, I know that some of you probably have to leave. You should feel free to leave if you have other things to do. All right, so here's an interesting experiment, I think. All right, so see what you guys think about this one. It's one that Kurt did a month or so ago. We went back to the parallel plate thing, and we wanted to ask what happens to the normal stresses during these flow reversals. All right? So during the initial flow where it jams, actually we've got something that looks sort of bizarre. All right? And obviously the shape of this is very, very sensitive to what the initial configuration of the particles is. But now it jams, you have some picture like this, all right? So now we reverse it and see what happens in this case. So when we reverse it, all right, and measure the first normal stress, notice that upon reversal here, we get initially a negative first normal stress, which makes complete sense, I would say. We've prepared the system. This is the first time we've made a jam like this. And so when we go to undo it, it's not too surprising that you get a big contribution from these forces that are trying to suck the particles apart, and then you get a negative normal stress. As you go the other direction, it becomes positive. Again, not surprising, right? That's what you'd expect to happen. It jams after all. Now you reverse it again. Want to predict what happens? Anybody? I get the answer. What do you think?
Ultimately, it will erupt.
Will it be negative when I reverse it again? Actually, when Kurt reverses it again.
Yeah. I'll say yeah.
Yeah.
No. Not. And if you go back and forth, it keeps on going up. There's a whole bunch of them there. Actually, if you plot the beginning normal stress as a function of run number, what you get is, this is this first one, which I discount. You get a negative one and then positive, and it just slowly grows the whole time, which I think is a little bit enlightening, or it begins to be a little bit enlightening, because this is consistent with this idea that I said before. When you reverse the flow, it doesn't really quite undo the jamming in the other direction. So what you end up with is bridges like this and bridges like this, neither of which are completely undone. And when you start reversing the flow, always give you
You're growing a competent solver.
Exactly. Exactly.
I said you're growing a competent solver.
Competent solver?
Yes.
Never heard that word before.
Not fragile.
This is a term that comes from people who look at wellbore stability in the oil industry, where if you have a granular material around the wellbore that fails into the wellbore, that's an incompetent
they're very civilized at Exxon, even when they're losing money.
It never happens.
Which basically
it's
never
happens. Going to happen in the future.
Right. At any rate, this I really liked. I thought that this was a really an interesting result, because it really does seem to tell you that these back and forth things are building up some sort of network, essentially, within the system. All right, so it jams both ways. I think there's sort of a limited amount of patience, but...
Does your height go down when you're moving back and forth, and the normal stress becomes positive?
It does go down a little bit, yeah, it does go down, yeah. Which means that you're building up the network. Good point. So here's another experiment you can do. You form a jam state. Right, you stress it, and you build up, say, some sort of bridge like that, a network of bridges, and then you just let go, apply no stress. All right. Well, if the particles are touching, it should recoil. All right. Now it does recoil. You can see that in the next plot. But one thing I want to point out is, if it were a rounded system, all right, you could get recoil just by virtue of the fact that by having done a finite strain, you would have disturbed the pair distribution function. And so as the system relaxes back to a homogeneous or an isotropic pair distribution function, you would get a stress that's generated by Brownian motion. We don't have that here. The Brownian motion really is completely negligible. So if it's going to recoil, it has to be because particles are compressed and they're uncompressing. And so that's what you see. You see relaxation curves that look like this. I don't want to dwell too much on this. What's more interesting, perhaps, is to look at what the total strain is when they relax. as a function of the stress that you apply. So here, this is the total recoverable strain, that is how much the thing recoils. And this was the stress that was applied that put it into the jammed state. And what you get, plotting it up in a log plot, is a slope of 2/3, at least up to some maximum strain where it begins to level off. And this is consistent with what you would expect, say, from Hertzian contacts. Yes?
I mean, from the intercept, you can get a volume density of contacts?
There's a few things you can do. I mean, you have to make a few assumptions about spatial distributions and so forth. And so then you can get some sort of estimate, say, the aerial density that involves particles on one or the other surface that are part of a chain that is supporting, you know, the lion's share of the stress. And you get rather low numbers for that, as I recall, under 1%, but on that order, a little bit under 1%. So, you know, I don't quite know what to say to that. I would have been upset if it came out to be 200%. I would have been upset if it came out to be 50%, actually. I would expect that to be some low number, but I don't know how, I don't have much intuition about exactly how low a number that should be. So that's an interesting question. I'll go through one quick thing right here at the end because I don't want to drag. I think people just get tired after a while. You can do flow experiments, all right? So either by working below the volume fraction where it jams or by going back and forth and making it flow at sufficiently high stress. And we've done a few experiments like that, and we looked at the particles with the sort of following scheme. We take a laser. What we do is we introduce some fluorescent dye into the liquid. And then we shine a laser through it. We actually make a sheet out of it. We have a cylindrical lens followed by a spherical lens, and that makes a sheet of light that goes through the sample like this. Since everything's index matched, this works pretty well. And then we look at the image of the camera. You have a filter here to filter out the light that's directly scattered, and so that you only look at the fluorescent. So that you only look at the fluorescent light. Look at from the side, then you should see where the particles are. And so, picture doesn't come out so well on this, but you can see here's where the particle is. Particles appear as holes in an otherwise bright background. So then you can do things like. Measure the pair distribution function. You can just find the particle centers, measure the pair distribution function. And what you find is that for a system either prepared in the initial state or a system that's jammed, remember it jammed after a strain of, you know, a fraction of a strain unit, you know, 0.1, 0.2, to the resolution that we can measure. Within the resolution that we can measure, you get a liquid-like structure factor or correlation function. You see, it's isotropic, at least in this is the flow direction, and this is the vorticity direction. The gradient direction is into the system right here. Once you get at the flow, though,
can you do flow versus gradient direction?
We can do that to a limited extent, and I'll show you a little bit of data there. All right, so here, if we look at the flowing one, where we got that kind of curve, here in that same plane, once it's flowing, you see ripples developing, all right, which says that in the flow direction, you're developing some sort of string ordering, essentially. All right, so particles actually are moving out of each other's way, in some sense, in order to form these strings. These have been seen in simulations as well. All right. Remember, though, you're not going to expect to see crystallization because the particles are polydispersed. Also, the edges are rough. So actually, you can even see it here. If you look down here, the reason we did this is because in looking at these pictures, if you look at them, you go, geez, it looks like they're ordered this way, and sure enough, it turns out that you actually do it quantitatively. You can you can do the following here. You can look into the gradient direction, or at least we can look into the gradient direction, with not quite by just rastering this beam back and forth. All right. Now, we don't get quite the resolution that we do in this plane, but you do okay. All right. And so you can try and look in that direction. And everything's moving slowly enough that you can do that. So here's sort of what you see. I've tried to make this a little bit comprehensible, although it's not perfect. Here's the particle original correlation with particles in this plane. So here's our central particle, and you're looking at other particles in the plane. You can actually then look below that plane. So you can look deep into the sample. You can correlate what's happening with the particle here with the particle that's happening in a little ways further or over here like this. And so that's what this line is meant to indicate. So we're correlating what's going on this plane with what's going on that plane. You get a correlation hole at the center because if there's a particle here, you can't have one there. And
in doing all this work with the optics, do you actually find the particle centers, or why don't you just correlate the light field without bothering to actually find the particle positions? Just regarding the light intensity of the surrogate for particle positions or a negative
circuit. Yeah, you can do that. I don't think we've tried doing that. That's an interesting idea.
My point is that you would spend a lot of time doing numerical.
Right, you might just. You might not have to do it. That's a good point.
In the simulations of modern dispersed systems, we indeed found that these structures were simpler to understand if you included the full particle form factor than if you stripped it off.
I see. That's a good idea. That may indeed be true. There's a little bit of a there may be a little bit of a complicating effect by the polydispersity, but it's not that big here. And so
I think it might again help. The picture is simply that if the system is really jamming up,
right?
If you're looking on some direction, it's really jamming on that direction, then it should look filled along that direction.
Right.
And so you see less correlation because the things are more uniform.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point, Jerry. And that's a good point. We actually tried that in a different experiment, not in this one at all, in some emulsion experiments we were doing. And it's a good point. We should probably be doing it here as well. It's easy enough to do. Right. No, it's easy enough to do. You may get better. It seems plausible.
There's probably a lot of misidentifications in images as well.
Right. That may be true. At any rate, you can see here that you get some sort of layer. All I wanted to show here is you can see some layer. You see it's fairly bright as you get down here. You see it's gotten darker, and then it gets bright again. That correlation hole goes away. So you can at least see in this you can see some layering, some evidence of layering. All right, and that's all I really wanted to point out here. You can just by looking at the gross differences. So it's not strong. It doesn't propagate very far. That is very many layers, but nearest neighbor, there clearly is some sort of layering on a sort of 1 to 2 particle scale.
What are you using as the reference, phase reference, for drawing this little diagram on the left showing what plane you're in? I mean, you're drawing the spheres there. What are those?
That's the mean size of a sphere in our system.
And also, you can slide that up and down any way you want.
No.
Is there some reference?
No, we're saying what we're doing is a correlation, all right, where you say, I have.
Oh, zero's there.
Zero's here. All right, that's zero's. All right. So this is sort of to help you think about it. All right, so that's just to say that it's a little bit later. I think actually I'll stop there because it's almost an hour and a half and people are probably tired, but. I'm happy to field questions and as people want. Yeah?
Concerning this first point here on the line, the gap dependent volume fraction, do you have some indication of some saturation of the effect or not?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, that gap dependent is really being. Very, very, very careful and modest. I mean, it was a very slight gap.
Do you have
Do you have a plot exactly of that?
Well, I can tell you what the data is. I could have plotted it up, but there's only 3 points. There's 2 millimeters, 4 millimeters, and 10 millimeters. And it varies between 55 and 54%.
Okay, but it depends on systematic or not?
It's systematic. It is systematic. It's not random. It's systematic, but it's just very weak. I guess I could plot it up, but you're going to see 3 dots there that are almost the same place, and I'm not sure how illuminating that is.
I think that this is the one thing that bugs me is that is this business about contacts and the fact that we haven't really tried to resolve the stress tensor into viscous and contact components.
I'm all ears about how to do that.
Now, I hear a cry of pain.
Well, because if you looked at those relative viscosities, they're up in the order of 10 to 3.
Well, no. It's I wasn't that. At jamming, that's not a problem for precisely the reason that Robin said, that the stress tensor has gotten so large that it's dominated by contact components and not by viscous components, and because you basically aren't flowing there anyway. But when you start to look at normal stresses in relatively flowing streams, I am concerned that, there might be a lot of information there if one knew how to resolve those.
Yeah, I think there probably is a lot of information in the normal stress measurements. I like to think of a better way of doing them. For example, perhaps a better, since the strains are relatively small, perhaps you can but this is a project, experimental project. You could imagine making a system that instead of relying on the sort of standard rheometer that does this by torsion, all right, and clearly that's done so you can have periodic boundary conditions, but there's no boundaries at all. But that's not important, or that's not very important, if the total strain that you're going to move is not very far. So a nice way to do the normal stress experiments in this case might be just to have a linear device. Now you have to make that yourself, you can't buy it. And it's not trivial, it's a project. So you want to be sure it's worth doing, can be done. I think to get measurements in this context that I really believe, that's one way of doing it. You could make a cone and plate device, perhaps, if you're willing to work with fairly. You want the gap size relative to the particle size to be a pretty big ratio. So it's possible that you could find just the right size particles and design a system where you could do the experiment that way as well. I really like the normal stress measurements, all right? We just thought of doing them a few months ago. If graduate students like to stay in my group for 10 or 12 years, that's the next thing I'd have Kurt do. But I think probably we'll get to that sort of in the next stage of this research. Because I do think, I agree, I tend to think that those normal force measurements are quite interesting. There's probably a good deal of information there. Gary, look like you have.
It'd be nice to figure out what it means. As you said, it's kind of counterintuitive, and it's a mixture of competing events. So it's not clear yet what you gain, but there's some information there.
Right. Yeah.
Perhaps one more question. In your experiments, you defined this, let us say, randomness taking by the behavior of viscosity.
Right, that wasn't me. You realized that was these other guys' idea, which
and at the
I
beginning,
kind of like.
Yes, okay, yes, well, I'm sorry. at the beginning of your talk, you referred to these experiments by Roda and Heidegger, who were considering dilatancy.
Right.
Do you have any explanation? And both your randomness packing are really close to each other.
Right.
And do you think these two phenomena apparently different, have a link with each other?
Well, that's a good point. I didn't make that point very well, perhaps. In this paper by this IBM group that I showed you right at the beginning, I mean, one of their main points was that where random loose packing happens and where dilatancy happens correspond, that those happen, that the onset of dilatancy happens at random loose packing. And that, in some sense, was the point of their paper. It's an intriguing idea. I, quite frankly, I haven't seen it followed up. I mean, I really like that paper. I think it's a very compelling paper. But I really haven't seen a lot of follow-up on that paper. It seems to, in some sense, kind of gotten lost in the literature, and I'm not quite sure why, because to me it raises some interesting questions.
Sure, they're not very precise for volumes.
Yeah, they're not so precise. So, you know, maybe someone could do better. Nevertheless, I just thought that they were interesting enough. Yeah. I wouldn't want to ignore them. Yeah?
It's more of a comment. I mean, you allude to a microscopic structure of
right.
streams. And, for example, I've seen simulations by the Carlson Group and many other simulations of granular media where it's in shear situation, there are strings. And I don't know if you envision those strings grow basically to span the system. It'd be nice to come up with a way to quantify those structures.
Well, one thing that I'd like to do that maybe some of you can help me with, I haven't made too big of a investigation of this yet. I mean, originally I thought that we might be able to look at the stresses in here because I was hoping these particles would be sufficiently birefringent that you could do it in that way. They're not. All right. We can't see any measurable birefringence in them. There probably is a tiny one, but whatever it is, it's too small to be useful experimentally. It would be nice, perhaps, to see if we could make particles that had these like Bob Berenger rings, where you could the photoelastic material. So I'd like to look into that and see what we could do. I think it would be quite illuminating to be able to look at those.
I'd like to ask about the role of polydispersity here. Mm-hmm. I mean, your system is not perfectly polydispersing. You said you liked the fact that there was some polydispersity in order to suppress ordering, but the strings seems to be an indication that there is still some order.
Right, right.
So what do you think would happen to the strings as you gradually make the system polydispersed, as you broaden the size distribution? You think the strings would get shorter smoothly and gradually, for example?
You know, I don't know. I mean, there's this thing that I said before when I misanswered the question. If you got a lot of polydispersity, you know, maybe the jamming would be dominated by the largest particles or the largest particles in the distribution. All right, and then maybe there'd be some tendency for there could still be some tendency to have some sort of ordering. At least certain particles within your distribution of particle size.
I don't think you can have jamming dominated by a minority of particles.
Well, it depends what you mean by a minority. Do you mean a minority of volume fraction or a minority of number fraction?
Number.
I'd say by volume fraction, I would completely
yes.
agree with you. By number fraction, I think you can have it by.
For instance, sand in air.
Right. Exactly. I mean, in ours, if you regard the solvent as small particles, obviously. I agree. I know that's.
I want to just gang up with Jerry and not let
good.
Off the hook here.
All right.
What are the prospects to do these experiments with more monodispersed particles?
We can do it. I mean, there's no reason. I don't know how monodispersed you can get, but you can buy these acrylic particles, or in our case, they were given to us.
I think you can get them as monodispersed as you can.
We sieve them. We do it by sieving, all right? So you can make the sieves closer together in size and get more monodispersed particles, and I think it's mostly a matter of patience.
But did you mention that you would like to avoid the
crystallization? Well, just because, I mean, this is the first set of experiments we did, and I wanted to look at jamming, and I did not want to look at shear and disordering.
I asked for the selfish reason that we did a lot of simulation on this with, I think we might have looked at some very, very mild polydispersity, but most of what we did was long dispersed, and as you say, the shear induced ordering is very interesting.
Right. Right.
By the way, the thrust of my remark was not that he should have done it differently, but that I doubted that he had really eliminated the ordering.
Well, clearly hadn't.
Clearly I haven't.
But it would be nice now that you've got that reference point to see.
Clearly that's a direction and parameter space that might be interesting to explore, both greater and lesser polydispersity.
Yeah, I would say in a parallel rotating plate system, even if you have it monodisperse, you'll have a lot of impacts.
So you
won't really have.
I mean, my recollection
you crystallize
from this that I'm thinking long ago.
I mean, in some sense, these experiments are realizations of many of the simulations you did.
Yeah, I mean, the flow-induced ordering we saw was a very much the same category. There was more complication, probably partly associated with the finite size of our sample, of
course,
which were as wide as yours, but we don't have the other two dimensions and further compounded by.
Now, one question I have for you, maybe for the audience here, is what role do you think friction between these particles is playing in the jamming phenomenon, in particular in the flow reversal phenomena that we observe? Do you guys think that friction between the particles is important?
If you're contact dominated, friction must be.
I mean, I tend to think that friction probably does play a role here. It's not something that you addressed in your simulation, as I recall, right?
Well, we did, in a sense, yes. Because what we looked at were simulations. Let me be clear, because other people don't know this work. These are simulations with a limited amount of the hydrodynamics in. We only had squeezed flow lubrication. And then we played with models of the interaction between the stabilizing copes and particles. Our particles were perfectly spherical, and so the one thing that intrudes on the hard sphere model is what the coat is. And you can play, the coat contributes in two ways. One, when you really bring the coats close, of course, you get steric hindrance. They help to prevent the particles going closer together and getting even more dissipation for relative motion, but they also give you an enhanced shear dissipation.
I see. Uh-huh.
What is the code problem? Is it real model? You're simulating actual molecules on the surface?
No. We use there was a standard model by Pincus and Co. that we plugged with. So there are models. There are semi-empirical.
Is there a potential? Is it geometrical?
It's inspired by thinking about an adsorb polymer layer. Now, so what we did was we varied the two relative contributions of this polymer layer. How much did it just keep the particles apart? How much did it really let the particles get ensnared in these layers and therefore very resistant to sliding?
Right.
And certainly see a big difference, and our continuation of our commercial sponsorship owed a lot to the possibilities that opened up.
I guess one thing that interests me is, you know, we get this buildup of this network on flow reversal, and my guess is that friction is important for that, and I would like to understand a little bit better the role of friction in the building up of those networks.
And I kicked myself that we did not study flow reversal.
Right.
There is another big difference that should be stated between the simulations and the experiments. I think I know where it comes from. While David's experiments are in particle terms 10 by a lot by a lot, ours were more like 10 by 10 by 10. A bit big. No, they did go bigger than that, but still, we're pretty limited. And the result was that we did not typically see jams at such small strains. And you can see the reason for that, because if you imagine that the experiment is equivalent to many of these simulations running in parallel, the experiment
right.
jams when the first region
yes,
jams.
Exactly, exactly.
So you see the tail of the distribution, you see in the small box
right,
simulation.
Right.
So I'm not shocked by that difference, but it does mean that it's a little bit hard to compare the jam states in
right.
the simulations with the jam states in the experiment. That's, of course, a condemnation simulation.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting thing. It says that that in an experiment like this, there's a certain size dependence that we really haven't explored, right? That is, if you use a smaller cylinder, if you could just somehow scale everything down, you know. But you clearly, in some sense, you need one jam, and it jams up the whole thing. So there's a certain sort of built-in size of that.
And this, if my observation is fair, this would complicate any attempt to interpret contact distributions through mapping into Hertzian models. Basically, the simulations, I'd say, well, you've not just got one characteristic jamming geometry. What you've got is you're forcing further and further and further. More and more regions of your coect are jamming up and
right. Okay, should we call it quits?